Good evening.
Good evening.
So this is module 15, the six paramitas. And I'm going to show you the book. The notes have the book spelled out in detail. It's volume 2 of The Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma. And the title for volume 2 is The Bodhisattva Path of Wisdom and Compassion. Am I speaking loud enough? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. By Chogyam Trungpa. And I really urge you to get this book. I know it's a big book, and we're only using a little bit of it relatively for this course, but there's a lot of other material, either for reference or other use in the future, in this book, so it really would be good to have a copy. I know you can get it Kindle, you can get it in various other versions, and I don't know if you're involved.
I can help if you need get a copy of the book. It's possible. I can't guarantee it that we could get the hard copy for 50% off the cover price. I have been able to do that in the past. I'm not sure that's going to be...
Okay, so...
If you want to contact me about that, I'll check your name down and I'll let you know in the next week if I can have that.
Thanks. So we'll deal with that after the class.
Yes.
Okay. So, that's the book. And the reading for this module, 15, is part 6 of the book. And the pages in the hardcover, and I believe in the softcover, are pages 193 to 296. So it's not all that much compared to the size of the book. It's part 6 of the book. And by the way, this is talk 1 on September 8th, 2016. And tonight we are going to talk about, first of all, the introduction. The title of the module is The Six Paramitas. And we're going to talk about an introduction to what is called paramita practice, and then the first paramita, which is called transcendental generosity. So first of all, the paramitas really are an activity, something we do, more so than something we study. We do study them, of course, but mainly it's how we actually do it which is important. So I'm going to give a little brief example. I'm sure other people can come up with them who are familiar with this. When Emily and I were married, we made offerings to the shrine. That is, there was a shrine and there were six different offerings, and we took turns. I make this offering, and then the other person, I make this offering. And there were six of them. And I'm going to read them. They're not in the same order as the order we'll be studying them. I offer this flower so that we may develop transcendental exertion. I offer this incense so that we may develop transcendental patience. I offer this light so that we may develop transcendental meditation. I offer this perfume so that we may develop transcendental discipline. I offer this food so that we may develop transcendental generosity. I offer this musical instrument so that we may develop transcendental knowledge. So the significance of this is that the Buddhist marriage ceremony here is one form of the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva vow is the main vow one takes if one actually enters the path of the Bodhisattva or the... Are we okay?
Yes.
Okay, the path of the Bodhisattva or the Mahayana. Mahayana meaning great vehicle. These two mean the same thing. So if you look in your notes, you'll see that... sorry, that's not the notes. Do I have a copy? Okay. Oh, we got extras. Okay. Well, I can share yours too. So the six paramitas are in a traditional order, which is transcendental generosity, transcendental discipline, transcendental patience, transcendental effort, transcendental meditation, and transcendental knowledge. And these things can be expressed in several other languages, including Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Pali. So paramita practice is the work of the Mahayana, or great vehicle. It is the vehicle of expanding our awareness and aspiring to help all sentient beings. That is what a bodhisattva is, someone who has gone beyond and not concerned with personal liberation anymore, but rather with liberating everyone. And that everyone can be as big as you can imagine. It can include millions of galaxies. It can include insects and termites. It can include your friends and neighbors. So there's no boundary to what a bodhisattva can aspire to. So the bodhisattva path is the same as the great vehicle, Mahayana, which means great vehicle. If someone needs clarification here, you're welcome to ask or just wait, whichever you want. So the bodhisattva path is often said to be the path of wisdom and compassion. And the paramita practice is more part of the compassion aspect. Why is that? Okay, compassion, because the goal here is to acquire the capability and skills and knowledge that one would need to be a bodhisattva. So to actually practice compassion, we need some sense of developing our skills. So the other side of it is the wisdom, which is actually seeing the profound, and I hate to use the word now, emptiness of all such activity. But we'll get around to that later. Don't worry about it. We have ways to deal with emptiness, by the way. We aren't going to just keep saying the word. So ultimately, wisdom and compassion have to be joined, just as... in order to be a whole person, one has to join the use of the right and left arms. One has to integrate the right and left hemisphere of the brains. One has to integrate heart and intellect. So there's a lot of joining and integrating in the path as a whole. But it also helps to talk about one aspect of it. And here the aspect is the acquiring of skillful means in order to be compassionate. There's some other terminology you might encounter, which is profound and vast. Profound refers to the wisdom aspect, because realization is so deep, or rather than high, maybe once I say deep, it goes so far into realizing wisdom that it's called profound. And vast, because the activity of a bodhisattva, the compassionate activity, is very vast. So wisdom and so profound and vast can mean the same as wisdom and compassion. A lot of this is, by the way, almost all of it is in the text when you do get a chance to read the text. And the notes you have here, I know they're thrown on you very quickly, have key phrases to point you into the text if you have it and are able to look it up. Yes?
I have a question. I mean, I know what the word transcendent means, yeah. But I don't... I read the text, and off the top of my head, I don't recall it being mentioned as much as it is in the notes. And
he mentions quite a bit, okay?
Gosh.
But it's there when you look for it, but okay. I'll go over just a little bit of... sorry, I drew a blank. Say it again.
Well, just the word transcendent.
Transcendent,
I mean,
sorry,
you,
yeah.
You were... You mentioned it a whole lot more than I recall.
Okay.
And of course, maybe...
Okay, so transcendental, in Sanskrit, paramita itself is the word meaning transcendental.
Uh-huh.
And it can mean gone to the other shore. That's discussed there.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so gone to the other shore. The other shore is beyond... concern for personal liberation, and it's also beyond any egotistical concept we have of what compassion means. So we're going beyond both dealing with our own suffering, and we're going beyond our own version of what it means to be a bodhisattva, beyond both of those to the far shore. When you hear the Heart Sutra, you've heard it at times. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi, swaha. It's about going to the far shore. So, let's see. The Mahayana is very much based on the Hinayana. Mahayana means great vehicle, and Hinayana means small vehicle. Hinayana is a small vehicle because it's the path of individual salvation. How do we transcend our personal suffering and go beyond it? That is the goal when we start on the Hinayana. Hinayana is very important. It's very important that we do not deprecate it or put it down in any way, because Hinayana contains the basics of meditation, how we can sit and not run away from our mind, how we can work with our thoughts rather than working with distraction, how we can keep coming back to being present, which is, of course, the very essence of the meditation instruction you heard a little bit earlier. So this is extremely important. It also teaches us, the Hinayana teaches us, not to use entertainment as a way of avoiding our mind or escaping from our mind, which we all have a tendency to do until someone plunks us down and says, do this. So it's just so essential that we do the Hinayana. Clear? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we always give and take, don't we? It is not necessary to perfect the Hinayana before we jump into the Mahayana, which is to say, I'm ready to take this vow, I'm ready to aspire to be a bodhisattva. It is not necessary to wait until we have done perfect Hinayana. We need to do some Hinayana, and we need to appreciate the value of that. We need to use Hinayana to have at least enough insight to see that taking the next step is the only possible way to go. That there's no just staying in the same place. So the path is always a moving thing. That's why we say grant our blessings, so that our mind may be one with the Dharma. Grant our blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path. Those are two lines we recited, which means that whatever we started out with, we're going through changes, and the way we look at it is going to change. So the Hinayana can lead us to the point where we see that this is a necessary step to take. It's not to tell anyone that they have to be ready for it tomorrow. A few people here have taken this vow. Others have no intention of doing it now, and all of that is okay. We're moving in this way, and we're not, simply not stagnating. So when we take the Bodhisattva vow, if we do that, we understand that we have not perfected the Hinayana, and we have the understanding that we're going to keep working on the Hinayana. Mahayana is always grounded in Hinayana. We do both practices often in the same time span. We have to start with Hinayana and do Mahayana. We never neglect the Hinayana.
Question, Michael. What would perfect Hinayana look like? And is that a real thing or is it an aspiration?
Well, I cannot say I understand it, but from a very traditional standpoint, there are said to be nine stages, and one can perfect them one after the other, getting to a point where the mind never wanders, and one is always on the point, and one's understanding is absolutely complete. And not having done that, I can't.
Are you still breathing then?
Yes. Yes, it's a practice for. If it's a practice to be done, it's a practice for live human beings. I mean, you just said when you got up and gave instruction, if you're alive, you're gonna, your next breath will come. You don't need to worry about it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But I wasn't promising anyone perfect.
I hope not.
Sit down.
Oh, okay. So mindfulness offers much greater, more durable freedom than any way of escaping our own minds, which is a reason for continuing the Hinayana. Do we know what a bodhisattva is? Bodhisattva is someone who has taken this vow. That there's two parts to it. One is jumping in and saying, I take the vow, which is what we do. And there's another aspect, which is actually going through it and completing it, which might take a very long time. So when we take the vow, we have no idea of how much trouble we're getting into and how long it'll take. But we're not giving up. When we take the Bodhisattva vow, we're saying, I'm going to liberate all sentient beings, no matter how long it takes, what difficulties there are, and so on. And as we do that, our idea about what we're doing, of course, will progress still further, and we'll have different notions of what we're doing. So the essential point of the paramitas is that they are transcendental. Paramita means transcendental, going to the far shore. So all religions and all ethical systems will certainly agree that generosity, discipline, patience, etc., are good and virtuous things to do. Everyone agrees with that. The transcendental aspect is going completely beyond any sense of me, why I'm doing it, what I might get from it, whether doing it depends upon being recognized, etc. So transcendental is going beyond whatever opinions, ideas, thoughts, however deeply buried we have about what we're doing. And of course that goes a long, long way, more than we realize. So it's completely beyond identification with me. What's in it for me?
Michael, do you know any bodhisattva?
At what level? Well,
you know,
a number of us here in this room have taken the vow, okay?
Right.
Which means that we're on the path.
Right.
Okay. Has my teacher completed the path? Maybe, but I can't evaluate that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It would be beyond my comprehension to understand and answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's fair.
So it takes a bodhisattva to identify a bodhisattva?
Well, mm-hmm. I guess we'll have to find out. However, we do have lots of ways to help. Talking about emptiness doesn't help. So we've got very specific things to do, and we've worked with some of them in the past, and we'll get back to some of them when we can. And three of them are Tonglen, Lojong, and I don't know who's been around that long. We did talk about the four limitless ones, which are also sometimes called the four immeasurables. But way, way back, I think we started with that. I'm sure you were around, at least. But they're there. Anyway.
Not when they were first.
Yeah.
So, or maybe I was.
So when the time comes, we can go back to these, or you can look them up, because actual practices are what's going to help. And the practices always turn our mind upside down. That's the nature of them.
So that actually explains, I was somewhat confused about the reading because it seemed like it was a description of the results rather than the process. The three chapters that we read for this week. And so basically you're saying that how we get there is through these techniques.
Yes. Part of what's there seems to me to be not well integrated with other parts, and I have. And if you're going to call me on that one, I'm not going to really be able to do much for you. We'll see what happens. So the point of paramita practice is to apply them very directly and personally to me, to look at what my mind is, what my mind is thinking, what is buried in my mind, what are my emotions, what are my conflicts, and to continually bring the paramita practice back to where, to use one way of saying it, where the tire hits the pavement, rather than any form of theorizing. And we mentioned this before, that paramita practice transcends both the simple ordinary pain of samsara. Do we know what samsara is?
Yes.
Samsara is living in continuously recycled suffering.
The
way we're handling the suffering just leads to more suffering. So
they don't
don't pick it up on Thursday.
I got it. The Tibetan word for effect is
Tuesday. I'm not sure.
I think it's Korwa, isn't it?
Korwa.
Yeah. And Kor is a root having to do with circles.
A wheel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Round and round the suffering goes. So that's samsara. And also we're transcending any notion of peaceful attainment or nirvana, because that's what we tend to believe about nirvana. And what we believe, what our theories are, what our ideas are, what our imaginings are, aren't it. So the far shore is beyond samsara and beyond conceptualized idea that we could obtain some peace where we are bothered. Good enough? Wow. Piece of cake. Okay. We'll see. We'll make it. Let's see if we can make a nice mess of it here. So, Paramita practice begins with generosity. That is the first paramita in the traditional order. And generosity is giving. If you look at the Sanskrit for it, it's dana paramita. And this Sanskrit word, dana, is etymologically related to English words such as donation. There is an etymological connection there. So generosity is opening up, having the strength and the courage to work with others. It's letting others have joy, for example, rather than letting them have joy and not holding back. It doesn't matter whether I've given them joy or I have nothing to do with it. It's unconditional. Let others have joy, peace, so on. So we're giving up any kind of stinginess, any holding back. And that includes psychological holding back as well as physical holding back. What are we holding? What are we not willing to give up? That is a very key point.
So I was going to say, what I thought about something I did, I think it was today, where a student, who I had this plan of what I wanted the kids to do, and the student really wasn't happy with it. It was a small group of kids. And I said, well, we're doing this thing because I'm the one that chooses what we do and directs. And as I look back at it, but that was a kind of grasping onto, I have a plan and I know what I want you to do, as opposed to sort of letting, like, for me it feels like it's a lot of not wanting to let go of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, so I have the plan, or I have a thing that's mine, and I don't want to give it to you because then I don't have it.
And we're not really capable of giving it up completely. Right. And there's no point in beating oneself up about it. You're just aware that you're not at that place. You're not a tenth Bhumi Bodhisattva yet. So, okay.
I have a question, though.
Yeah.
What is the Bodhisattva way in that particular incident? Is it, you know, allowing, if that person's like digging in their heels, one to say, what would you like to do? When she's the teacher, and I know in the reading it was interesting, if someone's a teacher, sometimes you can help, you know, lessen their karma in a certain way. I thought that was interesting in the reading. So I wonder, what's the bodhisattvic way?
You're not going to get an answer, okay? That is, you're there, you have to do something. You're, according to the best of your abilities, you're going to do it. And you did it.
Yeah.
And you're aware of any limitations of your own, and you've done it, and you just have to go on.
Yeah.
There's not going to be any formulas.
So I think, like for me in that situation, when I looked at it afterwards, I could sense some of it was my holding on to, like why are you the one who gets to decide what everybody does? I get to decide. So teacher, and that was my intention, was like, I'm the boss here. You know, I'm the boss of you.
Well, you are the teacher. You have to do it.
Maybe. No, but I don't have to be. But in a group of two students in a special program, I don't have to be the boss of, like, I made this plan and I liked the plan and I thought it was a good plan. And whether or not it's working, it's my plan. And that's kind of where that came from, I realized. In the moment, I was like, I was kind of feeling what you're saying, Megan, like, you don't get to run the whole show. But on the other hand, the show isn't me.
So is that when you do Tom Lin?
What? What was
it? Is that when you do Tom Lin?
Well, Tom Lin's kind of more practice to do the sitting. No, Tom Lin can be at any time too. But you don't have time to do exercises at this point. You're going to do what you do if you have the openness to have more flexibility rather than less. Maybe you'll be more flexible. Maybe it's total flexibility isn't a good idea. There's no answer. Okay, and even in retrospect, you may not get any answer. The situation just is open.
So the thing I recognize in what you're describing that I've experienced in different situations is that was me insisting on having my way because I'm identified with something, right? Mm-hmm. I want it this way because this is how I am. And that's where I notice I'm holding back. I really want to go on being just like this. But now that I see that, I think, maybe there are choices there. I wonder if I can take an example. I was working with a colleague today, and I made a suggestion about how we proceed, and he's like, "Well, that's not clear. Let's do it this way." And it was his way, and I'm like, "And I had this feeling like, oh, I'm no. Actually, it's really important to me that we do it my way." And before I shoved it down his throat, which I actually pulled up short of doing, I thought, oh, there's something going on here. I want something here, and I actually don't have to have this for this to come out okay. There's something it's a hook. It's a hook, and it turns into not just I want it, but it's me, right?
Well, I think it's that piece of like I'm competent. And my ideas are good ideas, and I'm that competent person. That's like who's coming in here, and it's not. There's a situation that I'm part of. It. It's like me and my competence are all
right here, and that's where I'm holding out.
So this is awareness on the path. That's why it is that. Your awareness will contribute to your next encounter. So
a few little lines I just picked out from the text, but I've had to abbreviate them, of course. So the nature of generosity is non-attachment. We've been working on that. Everything is not constantly dependent on what we want. Trungpa Rinpoche says in here, what about the rest of the world? In some cases, I should come last. Direct quote. That quote, I is like a sore thumb and always embarrassing and painful.
Good.
So, it's not that we can instantly vanish it, but that we become more aware of how clunky it is. In other words, we're going into the pain and the embarrassment and seeing something we didn't see before. Oh, I wrote, wow, this is interesting. Of course, I didn't have time to, my notes have to be compact. So, the Bodhisattva does not refuse a gift which is offered. That's been said, and it's traditional, and I think Trungpa does discuss it a bit here. Not quite as much as I'd like to see, but it said that a Bodhisattva does not refuse a gift. It may be a gift you don't really want, but why would a Bodhisattva not refuse a gift? Sometimes we don't want to accept a gift. This may be a fairly shallow example, I don't know. Because we want to make it clear we're independent, we don't need help. So if someone offers a gift, and a lot of people have been, this is not a solicitation, a lot of people have called up Emily and said, would you like a visit? And she says, yes, and could I bring something? Could I bring some food? And at first she's going to say no. And then she realized that accepting is important. And she started accepting this food. And aside from the fact that it's great to have it, it has given other people an opportunity to be generous. So generosity includes giving other people the option to be generous.
Does the Bodhi, as the aspiring Bodhisattva, feel free to give that gift away?
I had a great example of that. I was in Colorado recently. I went to see somebody, and he showered me these gifts. I have no idea why. I mean, believe me, he just had these big bags and kept on putting things out. Hey, here, here, and here. I'm like, no. What am I going to do with this? I have to come back, you know. And it turned out it was perfect. He gave me this big box of very expensive Japanese incense, which was in this very fine, finely crafted wooden box. Beautiful box. And these really long sticks right there, about that long. And I'm sitting there, God, what am I going to do? You know, because I'm not into Japanese incense. I had to stay at somebody's house who's a Zen priest. And suddenly I'm like, oh! And I brought it over and gave it to him. The guy was just floored. He just felt like it was so perfect. Yeah. So this was an opportunity to share what I have. If somebody gives you something, it doesn't mean you're stuck with it. You know? You don't have to swallow if they offer you a cup of poison. You say, I'll take care of it later, thanks. You know, just you know, feel free to share what you have. That's part of the thing. It's like it's not just stopping there. You know, it's like it can continue flowing. So, if anybody is intimidated, for instance, about or feels like they don't want to accept something because what am I going to do with this stuff? Then you have a stash of things to offer other people. That's another consideration.
Okay. I like when he said it's really important that when you're giving, you're giving something good and useful to the person.
Yeah.
And we're trying to do that. So it's not like, my husband is always like, oh, we have these old clothes someone could use. Well, right. Nobody wants your old dirty clothes. And he brings them to the clothing exchange and they throw them out. And I'm like, you could throw. Like, it needs to be that you're sharing. So you're sharing that incense with that one person. It was a great gift with other people. It was valuable, and for them it was like beautiful new clothes. Yeah.
Right, and you've done it in a way that doesn't insult the giver. That is, you're discreet.
I didn't tell him what I'd done with all the things he gave me, not to worry about.
Okay. Let's bring this up. Another interesting point, thank you. And giving generosity is also said to be the gateway to wealth. Generosity is the gateway to wealth. And that's really interesting. Transcendental generosity overcomes poverty mentality. Poverty mentality, I'm so poor, I have nothing to offer the world. Transcendental generosity overcomes poverty mentality. So when we truly experience that there's nothing to hold on to, this confidence becomes the experience of wealth. We have a lot to give. It doesn't depend on how affluent we are. That is, a bodhisattva has a wealth of peace and equanimity and happiness to give without making any demands in return. We can give what we have. We always have our, he says, we always have our smile to give. Yeah. Okay.
I like that part, actually, in the second chapter, page 208, 209. I mean, because I was thinking, I actually don't have a hard time getting rid of stuff because I've getting rid of stuff, giving it away, because I don't like clutter. And then I thought, I'm giving a lot of things away just to satisfy my own ego that doesn't like a lot of clutter. And is that, what kind of generosity is that? But he talks quite a bit about the generosity of your being, generosity of your, and he said your smile, your loving kindness to others. Giving up your anger is also a form of generosity, and giving up your judgment. And so this to me was like, oh, there's the meat of generosity here.
Yeah, excellent. He says something else too. A bodhisattva has a wealth of peace, equanimity, and happiness to give without making any demands in return. Mm-hmm. We're not going to turn sour if our smile is not accepted. Okay. We've given it. We're not making a demand. Okay. Generosity overcomes the compulsion to give away our capital. That's a direct quote in the book. So we give what is appropriate and of benefit to the receiver. We don't give in such a way that we have given away our own basis for instance, our physical or mental maintenance. We don't give and then say, oh, now I've given, now I'm penniless, someone better help me. Giving in a way that makes us helpless and dependent is not really a gift to the world. So we give what is appropriate and of benefit to the receiver. It's also said that giving to a worthy person is better than giving to one who is not a worthy person. He makes a very strange example. Like, you wouldn't give food and a place to live and so on to someone who's developing an atom bomb. Okay. Well, I'm rather surprised he said that. I never heard him say anything like that other than in this book. But it's also not a good bodhisattva action to simply give to someone who's going to disregard it, waste it, give even immediate help to someone who is going to simply discard it and 6 hours later needs the same help again because that person is not in any mental state to help themselves. Mm-hmm. So there's a limit to what you can give, what makes sense to give, and what is simply exhausting oneself and of no benefit.
What I really appreciate, the bottom 209, top of 210, is essentially he's saying, you give from your excess, not from your core. you know, which I think is kind of important, especially when I first, I don't know, when we were way back when discussing bodhisattvas and who is the bodhisattva, I was really like, no, I can't give any more. You know, that was really my thought. And it feels like, I know I'm admitting it, and I'm selfish. But, you know, the thing is that I think it's what I think I'm reading, and what I appreciate is that there's giving, and then there's giving too much, like you were saying.
Yeah.
That is, it's inappropriate and not fair to the other person, and certainly not to yourself.
Right, that's true. I learned a lot about this, by the way, in Joanna Macy's teaching. She works with this theme continuously, how not to burn out, how to accept help when you need it, how to use community rather than exhausting yourself, and so on.
Could you go over again what you said about the, you know, avoiding giving to somebody who's just going to repeat the same thing over again? And what I have in mind is addiction, plus also like the doctors who may be in one army, but they're willing to, you know, repair a wounded person in, on the other side. Yeah. Who may get up and, you know, tomorrow wants, you know, kill somebody.
That's pretty tricky. I mean, can a doctor impartially help wounded people of both sides? I think very often that could be virtuous. You're asking the doctor to, first of all, fixate my side's right and the other side's wrong. So I don't know that I'd take that as an absolute rule, that you should only help your own side.
Well, that's interesting because that's been brought up in Syria where, you know, he had doctors working in hospitals and they said, look, I took the Hippocratic Oath, I take whoever comes in the door. I don't ask you what you're doing with the gotcha in this situation or which side you're on. You just work with what's there. You work, and I think that's part of the giving process itself, is actually a willingness to work with what's there, presents itself. But, you know, aside from that kind of extreme situation, you're capable of making discernments about, you know, what kind of help a person can have and what kind of help you can offer, right? It isn't just totally unconditional to everybody and under all circumstances, right?
Well, it seems it's an everyday observation. And the decision often, like I say, especially in emergency rooms, you know, they see the same people coming in. You know, I get a number of friends who are active addicts who just keep going into the ERs. So, you know, we're all grateful that there's some sort of resources that keep them going so that eventually they may change. But there's certainly an attitude that is virtuous in that they say we're not judging if the person is ever going to come back again. But there are plenty of businessmen that hold back resources, you know, insurance companies or, you know, medical industries, you know, holding resources in order to just use it as specific.
Well, those aren't examples.
That's a
different brand.
No, that's the opposite. He
addresses that on page 209. Generosity is not based on despising others or looking down on them. If you do not respect others, you cannot offer generosity to them. Generosity is conceived out of compassion, tenderness, and benevolence, so respecting others is a very important point. Even though a person might not seem to be worthy of respect, if you can come up with even one respect-worthy quality, you can use that as the ground to work with such a person. People should not be left under the influence of the Maras, the evil ones.
Okay.
What does that last sentence mean?
Maras that are the ones that the evil, the demons that try to make you be a bad person or do bad things. And so
we should find that quality so that this person isn't left to somebody else's.
No, but he's just saying even though a person might not seem worthy of respect, if you can come up with one respect-worthy quality, you can use that as the ground to work with a person. Don't abandon a person to the Maras, is what I think he's saying. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah.
What about the monks and the others who go around with begging bowls and people give them food and...
That's not,
so that's an interesting sort of relationship.
Yeah, but it has to be understood. I don't know if we have time to go into all of that.
Yeah.
Of a particular culture in India at that time, and if we don't understand that, we really can't.
Yeah.
It's quite different than begging here.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
It's understood differently. Mind is different. And even that has rules.
It's sort of like a basket in the back of the room. Mm. Yeah, I mean, but asking for charity, for support, for a good cause.
Well, I think that I view it as that, you know, they're doing something virtuous and somebody is supporting that path. And that's how that
yeah, there's a context in which that happens.
Yeah.
We're kind of near the end, and I want to announce these topics, which were for then. I'll stop talking in just a minute. There are traditionally three levels of giving. They are described in the text and are worth discussing. So I'm not going to discuss them. I'm just going to recite them and end, and you can decide if you want to discuss them because they're very interesting. The three levels of giving are material giving, the gift of fearlessness, and the gift of dharma. Three of them. Material giving, the gift of fearlessness, the gift of dharma. They are elaborated in your reading. So I can say, of course, there are many subtleties to understand here. It is always necessary to keep understanding, keep opening our minds and realizing how much more there is to anything that we know. For instance, you would not be giving dharma very well if you started giving Buddhist teachings to someone who didn't want it. But there are other ways of giving dharma by one's presence. The gift of fearlessness is particularly interesting, and I'm going to stop talking and open it up.
If everyone read that,
It seems like a lot of, for me, the generosity is around believing that I have enough. So if I have enough, whatever that means for me, then I can give away because I already have enough. Everything past that, maybe even some of what is my enough, I can give away, including some of the fear is like I'm holding on because I'm afraid it won't have enough. What if tomorrow I trip and break my leg and I don't have a job and I won't have food, so I can't possibly share?
What is the gift of fearlessness? How can you give the gift of fearlessness?
I think of it as spaciousness.
Uh-huh.
That I think specifically of a good friend of mine who, whenever I was in her presence, I felt like everything was going to be okay. And it wasn't because she was telling me that or she was enabling me in any way, shape, or form. I just felt like this total spaciousness.
Does it give you the confidence that you can handle whatever it is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did she feel that way about herself, her situation? Did that get transmitted somehow?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for her, but my sense is she was a very grounded human being. But she had her issues, too. She was very comfortable with all of it.
Uh-huh.
Just about every president of the United States is going to make some promise about prosperity. There's only one president I know of who said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Actually, wasn't that FDR, right?
Yeah.
FDR.
It was FDR, yeah. He said that right at the beginning. He went into the second level of giving.
That's really interesting, too, because saying that and just see how some politicians seem to capitalize on fear. That's a driving force to persuade people or to get them to think that, yeah, things are pretty horrible and, you know what, you're our savior and you're the person that's going to bring us out of this samsara.
There was something, I don't remember if it was in one of the class books, but the phrase of going beyond hope and fear, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, Trungpa talks about that. Yes, that's a very important Buddhist and Shambhala teaching, beyond hope and fear.
Yeah. It seems to me that our parents, you know, have experienced this many times. I'm not a parent, but it seems to me they put themselves in an unknowable future of a certain circumstance. But if they're protecting their child, they're going to put themselves in between, you know, whatever it is, not knowing what the outcome is, but knowing that the immediate threat is to be blocked. It seems to me all you parents, you know, experience that type of generosity.
It's
a pretty good resource to build
upon. If we can give the gift of fearlessness, that is a gift of confidence which might ripen, and we'll never know whether it does or not, but it might ripen. It might ripen in some very young person after we're dead, and we'll never know it. Mm-hmm. But that gift is given. I think it's given by lots of people in certain situations. It's given by a lot of teachers of children, that you can't get a reward. You don't know what the effect of what you're doing is. We really don't know what we're setting in motion, and yet we aspire to open and give gifts, meaningful gifts.